This is April 30th, 2008, with the Oral History of the Bracero Project for CSUCI. And the interviewee is Maria Coyer, and the interviewers are Julie Manicus and Jamie Williams. I'm Julie Manicus, and we're here with
Maria Collier.
And I'm going to do the first half of the interview.
Okay.
When and where were you born?
I was born in 1949 here in Oxnard, California. At that time, it was Oxnard was still a relatively small town, and the hospital was Lying In Hospital, which is kind of odd, huh? That's an odd name. But anyway, it was on 5th Street and H Street. It is now a low-income housing project. So.
And then tell me about your family and your hometown.
My family, my mother, her name is Maria Elena Garcia. She was born here in Ventura, California. My father, his name was Merced Raya. He was born in Irapuato.
Guanajuato.
Sorry. Guanajuato in Mexico. I'm trying to think of what year. I don't remember the year that my father was born. I'm sorry.
Okay. So what did your parents do for a living?
My father was originally came here. He was a field worker. He had several jobs, but when he retired from Sunkist Growers, and it was here in Oxnard. It was a conglomerate of different ranches that grew
Coastal Growers
citrus.
Association.
Is it
Coastal
Growers?
Association.
But it was a part of Sunkist.
Yes.
Yeah.
Citrus growers.
Okay. My mother worked as a dry clean in a dry cleaners for years. I can't remember. Maybe 25 years, and then decided to go to work as a housekeeper for St. John's Hospital, which is still here in the area, and retired from employment from St. John's at about 60 years old.
Did your parents own their own home or property?
Yes. Growing up, we lived in several different homes throughout Oxnard, and eventually when I was about 9 years old, my parents bought a home in South Oxnard. And we moved into a home, and I still live there.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah.
And did you come from a large family?
Yeah. Alice is actually my sister-in-law. Mm-hmm. And so I think we met when I was about seven or eight. She was dating an older brother.
58.
Yeah. So about... Nine,
yeah,
right about the time we were moving. We lived in Colonia here in Oxnard, which is a predominantly Hispanic community, and moved to South Oxnard, which was across town, and into a housing tract, which was, when we bought it, I think the house maybe was maybe about 9 years old. It was relatively new. And it was a relatively new area. Middle income, predominantly white families lived there. So it was an adventure, to say the least, for us to move there. We were a very large family. I had seven sisters and three brothers. The three youngest were actually my father's. The others were from a previous marriage, my mom. So we all, when we moved into this house, there were still, I'm going to say there was four or five girls.
The three oldest were married.
Yeah. So it was
Gilbert, Arnold, Trini, Patsy, Adeline, and the three of you?
Yeah.
That's still eight.
Yeah, there was still quite a few of us. I'm trying to think of all the sisters that were still there. So I think there was five of us out there, and then my two oldest brothers. We all lived in this house. It was a, for us, it was a very large home, having come from, you know, about a 500 square foot home in Colonia, where we all lived. There was 11 of us there, and my two brothers slept in a washroom. Six girls, six of us slept in one bedroom. One of us kind of shared my parents' bedroom, because the youngest one actually shared my parents' bedroom. And that's where we lived for a long time. Maybe 5 years, I think, we were there. And prior to that, I think we lived on, well, I'm not really sure. I know we lived on Garfield, which is right across from the, on 3rd Street on Garfield. And there was maybe a couple of other places that we lived. But it was a really interesting childhood. Very interesting.
What's one of your favorite memories?
I have a lot. But I can give you an example of our culture shock when we moved into this area. We thought this house was just enormous. I mean, we just couldn't believe it. I remember it had hardwood floors, and so we used to just put our socks on and just slide across the floors because it was large. I mean, the other home we had, you can imagine a 500 square foot home is, you know, we were bumping into walls if you turned around. So this home just seemed large to us, and it had a fireplace, and it was just really a massive backyard. It was really big. And even now the backyard is still really large in comparison to a lot of homes. But some of my fondest memories living there, looking back on things, is that when the neighbors started to realize that we had moved in, and I remember one time we had one of the neighborhood children came to visit and kind of explore, find out what we were all about. And he looked at us, and he looked at me, and we were talking, and he says, how come you're always having these great big parties, and there's always so many people here? And I looked at him kind of strange, like, what parties and what people? And he goes, well, there's always all these kids here. And I said, we live here. And he said, you know, he was just in shock. But in retro, you know, in the reverse of that is that when we went to go visit and explore things with our new neighbors, our new friends, came to realize that the families in our neighborhood were really small. They only had one or two children, and some of these children had one bedroom all to themselves, which was, it was amazing to us that anyone could have their own bedroom. You know, you have all of this, you have your own bedroom. It was really a culture shock, you know, and it was for them also. But it's kind of funny when you look back and they thought we were celebrating all the time when it was really our way of life. So that was one experience. Another experience was it actually involved my parents and my dad especially, was at Christmas time. And one day my parents had, we had a lot of kids and grandkids. But my parents liked the neighbors a lot, and they in return, you know, really cared about us as neighbors, and so we were really friendly. There wasn't any animosity because of being Mexican or because we were different. You know, there really wasn't a lot of animosity about that. So one year my parents decided to have a Christmas party, and my dad decided that he would ask one of the men that worked with him if he would play Santa Claus. And so this big, tall, Mexican speaking, you know, Spanish speaking Mexican came into the house, and so we had a costume for him, a Santa's costume, and we dressed him all up, but he couldn't speak English, and a lot of the kids at the party spoke English, and so he tried really hard. Here was this man that lived on the camp, in the labor camp, and he decided to come to this Christmas party and dress up as Santa and be our Santa for all the kids in the neighborhood. And everybody, all the parents brought gifts that we could put in a sack. And my mom and dad provided the refreshments, all the treats and everything. And here was the Santa who the children were thrilled to see that couldn't speak English and had a really difficult time pronouncing names in English. But everyone still enjoyed it, and he was just having a ball. To see somebody that was from another country come in and share this experience with us, and then, you know, was willing to you know, give his time, but then also enjoyed the companionship of all these families getting together. It probably what must have been a really lonely time for him was really, it's a memory, you know, it really is. It stands out in my mind as one of the best memories, I think. So.
Do any of your brothers and sisters live around here now?
Yes. I have one, my younger sister lives in Colorado. My youngest sister lives here in Ventura. My other brothers and sisters live close by, and then my older sister lives in Texas. So most of us have remained in this area.
And are any of other your brothers or family members work as a bursario as well?
No, they did not. The girls, as teenagers, my dad would take the boys to the fields to work to earn extra money, not because he wanted them to or anything, but they were teenagers and they wanted extra money. So he would say, "Okay, if you want to come and work in the fields, you can pick lemons and work like everybody else." And they did. But you know, I can tell you some stories about some of the things they used to do because my dad was the field foreman, and so they kind of took advantage of that when no one was looking. They would go and from other boxes and kind of dump it into their sack and pretend like they hadn't picked it all. So they would play things. They would do things like that. My dad got wise to it real quick and so put an end to it. But those kinds of things happened. And, yeah, they would work out there. But it wasn't because they had to. It was really their choice. And then my older sisters sometimes would work in the packing house. And then I remember a couple of times they tried working in the strawberry fields, but it was really hard work, and they learned after the first day that maybe this wasn't something they wanted to do. So that was a really good experience. You were talking about some of the memories, so now that I'm talking, some of these are coming back. So I hope you don't mind if I, you know, just start telling you some of this stuff. Do you want to go?
Home and I'll come back.
Okay. Okay. I hope you guys are going to delete me. So one day what happened was we were driving through town. And at that time, when I was growing up here, we were still living in Colonia, so I must have been about 8 years old. We were driving through town, and there were still a lot of trucks that carried the braceros, or, you know, the field workers. They would carry them in army trucks, canvas-covered army trucks with the benches across the back. So those were from the 40s, and I think they were World War II equipment or maybe even Korean War equipment. And so the men would ride in the back of these trucks, and so they had canvas covers that they would open up to ventilate, and then the men would be looking out. So if you pulled up behind them, you could see all the men. You could see the rows of the men looking, you know, sitting there. And so we happened to drive up behind one of these trucks, and we were sitting in my dad's station wagon, and we're all kind of, you know, the girls, and we were young, and some of us were preteens, and my sisters were preteens, and I was still a grade school kid. And we're looking at the truck, and we see these men, and they're staring back at us. You know, we're a family in a vehicle, and they're men that are living in labor camps, and they're kind of, you know, peeking out at us, and we're looking back at them, and we're kind of giggling, and my dad's, you know, thinking about this, and he goes, "Well, what are you laughing about?" And I go, "Well, you know, they look a little, you know, they're just staring," or, you know, we were a little uncomfortable with their staring, but we were not really realizing that they were maybe going through, you know, missing their own children, and they were seeing all of us together in a car, and, you know, so my dad, you know, just didn't say much, thought about it, didn't say much, and we drove on, and they drove on. So a few weeks later, Saturday morning, my dad had left to go to the packing house, and then when he came back, he drove up in a big labor camp truck, canvas-covered truck. And we're looking at him and go, well, how come you brought this truck home? And he goes, well, come on, we're all going for a ride. And so he packed us all up in the back of this vehicle, you know, in the back of the truck. We're all sitting on the benches where all these men sit. And he drove us all around town. And we had to sit in the back of this truck and look out at people staring at us. And he, you know, he explained later on, he really wanted us to get a sense of what these men go through, what, you know, the fact that, first of all, they're here to do a job, and you know, they're not to be ridiculed. It's what they're doing. And then to get a sense of what it feels like to be riding around in the back and looking at people that have, or even look down at you because you're riding in this truck. How misleading that can be. So it was a really good lesson for us. My dad had a way of teaching us lessons without lecturing, or sometimes with lecturing, but, you know, letting us know. Had a real good way of getting lessons to sink into our heads and learn.
So did your dad meet your mother here?
Yeah. Let me get some more. Yes, they met here. I don't know if they want me to share this story or not, but my mom one day was working at a cleaner's that was at the end of town, and when you're entering Oxnard on Oxnard Boulevard on 5th Street, there's a railroad tracks, and then you'll start to see some buildings, and there was a cleaner's in that area. It's no longer there, but there used to be a cleaner's, and so sometimes she would cross the street to go and get something from the little store that happened to be across the street. And so one day my dad came driving the truck and had the guys in the back to get them to the field and driving them back to the camp. And my mom was going to cross the street, and he stopped, and she walked across the street, and he decided to time it the next time around. And so, you know, this went on, and eventually they met, and you know, the rest is history, so to speak. But, yeah.
And what is your mom's background?
My mom is, she's Mexican. She was born here in Ventura. My grandparents were born in Chihuahua, Mexico. And my mom was raised. Part of her growing up years were on the Camarillo Ranch, where she worked as a field hand or worked around cleaning house, but she was a little girl still. But my grandparents worked on the farm there, so on the ranch there. And so she went to school in Camarillo up until the age of 9 years, and then at that time she had to come and start working. So she left school at fifth grade. So she went to school up until the fourth or fifth grade.
Did she teach you anything? Did she teach you any of the things she was working, like how she...
How, well, you know, what she talked to us about is... You know, some of the things that she would do on the ranch would feed the chickens. She talked about people, because some of this was, I'm not sure if it was during the Depression, it must have been maybe the early 40s. But people were coming into California, and the ranch was pretty open, you know, and so people would stop there, the Camarillo Ranch. And she tells stories about her mother feeding travelers, you know, as they came through, not for money or anything, but because sometimes they just didn't have money, and people were needy, and so she would provide whatever they had, she would share with them. She remembers going to school on a buck horse, you know, in the buck wagon, where they would be flat, and they would all ride to school with a horse, and some of the people that she knew in town, business people, she knew from grade school in Camarillo. So it was kind of interesting to know the history and know where some of these individuals came from.
And it sounds like your family was more of the upper class?
Upper class?
Or like your dad was in the forehand?
Well, he was a foreman. It wasn't really upper class.
Mm-hmm.
I think when he first came here, when he started the bracero, when he came as a bracero, he was working in the fields. He was picking lemons.
Mm-hmm.
He eventually moved up to a supervisor and a foreman, and you know, he did other things for the company. But originally, he came here as a field hand.
Okay. And then tell me about your schooling, where you went to school.
I went to school in Oxnard. I went to grade school in the Colonia area, Juanita School. It was an elementary school, Ramona School. And then when we moved to South Oxnard, it was in the grade school at McKenna and, you know, local schools. I went to high school in Wainamie High School in Oxnard, and graduated from Oxnard High School after, because I got married in between, so I got married really early. And then I went to Oxnard College, and then since Oxnard College, I've taken other courses that have led me into what I'm doing now, which is a program manager for a nonprofit organization. But it was interesting, too, because one thing that my parents taught us was a work ethic. I mean, whether I completely, you know, my parents really wanted me to finish school and go on to college, but what I ended up doing was getting married, and which was acceptable at that time, and there wasn't a real push, even though, you know, even though we aspired to do that, it didn't necessarily happen. We were talking about school. I'm trying to think of where it led me. going back to school, yeah, I liked going to college. I went to Oxnard College. I went ahead and took some more courses through LA Trade Tech for labor. So I did some labor classes there because I ended up being a labor representative. So I worked for a union that represented a lot of cities and county positions. I also worked for a short time as a job developer for the County of Ventura. And that was really interesting work. And what I'm doing right now is working as a domestic violence program manager, and I manage all of the shelters and transitional shelters, all of the programs and the budgets and everything else that go along with this. So a lot of work. Yeah.
End of session one.
Okay, now I'm Jamie, and I'm going to ask some questions about the Braceto program.
Okay.
When was the first time you heard about the Braceto program?
I think I grew up hearing about it. I can't remember when I didn't know about it, because you grew up in a household where, first of all, Braceto, my father was a Braceto, and growing up with it, there was a lot of discussion about your roots, where you're from. Are you an American? Are you a Mexican? That was a real issue, I think, for a lot of us growing up here, because our parents really wanted us to be American. And that's why they came here. A lot of them came here to work, to earn a living, and some of them thought they were going to go home and, you know, return, and many of them did. But, you know, so I grew up hearing about I just don't remember a time when I didn't hear about it. One of my first recollections as a child, and one I don't really forget, it's really unusual how you remember certain things in your life, but I remember a kind of a game that my mom and I used to play, because when my dad returned to Mexico to apply for legal residency here, he had to leave the country, go back to Mexico, apply for the residency before he could return. So there was a lot of, you know, he left for a period of time, an extended period of time. And so I remember being about 3 years old.
Wow.
When that happened. And I still remember, you know, my mom would, you know, write or read me letters that he would write to us, or show me cards that he would send to us. I remember that. I must have missed him deeply, because it still stays with me. And I remember listening. We have Oxnard Airport, and we had a small airport at the time. It's still in the same place. It's never moved or anything. So the planes would fly over our house where we lived. And I remember when I'd hear the planes, my mom would say, well, there's your dad. He's flying in the plane. And, you know, so those are just, you know, vague recollections of knowing that my father had left us to go somewhere else, but was returning, you know, so.
Right. And when was the first time that you actually met, like, a bracero that wasn't your father? Like, he'd bring friends over? Or
he would bring friends over. My godfather was a bracero. His name was Pete Guerra. And then there were other friends that we knew through school, you know, other families that we went to school with, and their families were also braceros. They worked in the fields, or, you know, and so, yeah, they would come to the house. We would have people that came to the house. And there were times, because my dad had a relationship with my mom or the marriage with my mom, that there were times he would bring people home. I think I mentioned this before at another interview, but, you know, and they would bring him home for dinner or for a beer or whatever, and give him a break away from the camp to come in and visit. And
you said that your parents wanted you to be American. So did you, was Spanish your first language talked in your home, or?
You know, early on, Spanish was my first language. But growing up in an American school, growing up here in the United States, I mean, I was born here, but also living in a Hispanic community at that time was very different than what we see now. So when I grew up in school, the focus for the schools in our area was to Americanize the Mexican children, is to acclimate them to the culture, the country, you know, all of these things. So Spanish was not allowed when I went to school. We were not able to speak Spanish. That was really, you were actually, it was, you know, you were punished for speaking Spanish. They encouraged you to speak English, and one way they encouraged you was you'd get in trouble if you spoke Spanish. We didn't have Spanish-speaking teachers. We didn't have Spanish language books. We didn't have things that we take for granted now, we didn't have. So you quickly acclimated to the language and, you know, and learned not to speak Spanish. Now, when you got home, our parents spoke Spanish. So you, just by hearing, you learned the language and you understood the language. But little by little, you learn to speak less and less of it. So you have a whole generation of Mexicans that maybe are sometimes first-generation Mexicans that don't speak any Spanish at all. So, you know, you do see a lot of that. And people don't understand it, but if you look back into what was going on at the time in the school districts and the schools, that's actually what was happening.
And Did you teach your parents what you were learning in school, like the English? Or
my father was self-taught, so he spoke English very well. He learned. He forced himself to learn, and he taught himself. And my mother already spoke English because she had lived here all her life, so she spoke English and went to school here. Mm-hmm. But my father taught himself English very early on and learned how to speak English very well. Now, one of the things that was really interesting is because my father had learned the language, when he was working at the labor camp, he actually taught English as a second language. Wow. Before there was English as a second language. He taught English to the braceros that were working there. The other thing that he did, his life is very interesting, and I'm sure a lot of men will tell you and families will tell you similar stories, I'm sure. But he also taught, and what he did is he translated, like, safety manuals for the work, and he translated driving tests, because not only did the laborers have to, you know, they worked here in the fields, but some of them were good drivers but needed to take the test or wanted to purchase a car or a vehicle so they could travel home. And so he taught them how to take the driving test before it was ever translated to Spanish. He translated it for them and then taught them and then helped them go and apply for their driver's licenses and then, you know, just help them with that. Some of the things that happened, so I'm going to go ahead and tell you about these things because I'm on it. Okay, so some of the things, the stories that I remember hearing and some of the things that my father would talk about was the fact that, you know, when the laborers actually worked and lived in these camps, some of them were very unscrupulous, and as you can imagine, they were taken advantage of. And you hear this like in the Graves of Wrath, and, you know, and people would take money from them. But they were labor camp operators that actually took advantage of these guys being here, these men being here. And so they were only allowed to shop in certain stores, you know, and they were only allowed to buy in this particular store, that particular store. They didn't have the right to go anywhere they wanted to find the best deal or the best, you know, a bargain, so to speak. So they had to spend it, and some of these stores also took advantage of the fact that they were here, and they would charge them higher prices. So there was a lot of that going on too. And some of the businesses in Oxnard, even though no one wants to admit, were established in some of these families that received, that are, you know, better off than others, or that have more money, or that started businesses at that time, actually were started on the backs of some of these men, you know. So and so their labor provided them with a better standard of life, but it was at an expense. And so, you know, when my father at one time or another, and I don't remember when it happened, but I remember one time he decided that he was going to leave the camp and he was going to go and try to find his own place to live, so that he wasn't, you know, because he realized he was being taken advantage of. And so he did, you know, he did that. And he did well. He did fine. And later on, turned around and started teaching men when he was able to reestablish himself with a good employer, reestablished himself and was able to start teaching men how, you know, how not to be taken advantage of, you know, how to, you know, use their rights here in the United States to their advantage, really. So, you know, he was kind of a pioneer, I think, in that area.
Did you have any other relatives that were Brissettas, or was it just your dad?
It was just my dad. We had friends that were, but it was just my dad in our family.
And was he an only child?
No, no.
So where were all his brothers and sisters?
They were all in Mexico. They lived in Mexico. So one of the stories, he hadn't seen his brothers, or, you know, we really didn't get to see them. I think he went back two times. One time to reapply for residency, and then he went back another time before his mother passed away. But what happened was in the 1970s, in the 70s, we found out that he had his brothers that lived in Caborca, Mexico, which is inside of Yuma area. Mm-hmm. So if you go into the Yuma area and you cross the border, and then there's some towns that are inland up there. So, and the name of the town was called Caborca. And so at that time, my husband and I decided we would take him there to see if we could find his brother. And my father was very ill at the time. He had a really bad heart. And so, so this was going to be his last opportunity to really connect with family, and so we decided to make the trip and go there. And so we drove and we found the town, and we went into the town and started asking, because we had no idea where they even lived. We knew they were there, we just didn't know where. So we went into town. It was a small town, and so we decided let's go there and see, you know. And so we did, and he started asking and asking. And finally somebody said, yeah, we know who he is, and this is where he lives. And so they drove us. They let us follow them to this place, and here we are. We're strangers to this place, and we're going, okay, so where are we going to be led to? Because what they did is they actually had a gathering of families that came together and purchased some land and started farming it. And so they lived on this property. So we drive up, and it's dark, and, you know, we're total strangers, and my this man gets out and he knocks on the door and says, you have somebody here that's visiting and they'd want to talk to you. And, you know, and we're in the car and the headlights are on these people and all we see is, you know, these figures and we know they're talking. And I see my dad talking to this man and all of a sudden you see them embracing and then everybody's crying, we're crying, they're crying. My dad had not seen my brothers for 30 years. I mean, his brothers for 30 years. They didn't even recognize each other at first, and they really had to stare into each other's eyes to realize that this, he was actually his brother, you know, and so they were embracing and crying, and then, of course, they invited us in. And I got to meet cousins I never knew I had, and, you know, it was... And their their way of living was very rural. It was an adobe house. It was a dirt floor, but it was very clean, and everything was just so warm and inviting, and it was so great to see cousins. And I mean, for me, it was really actually wonderful because the only cousins I knew were on my mother's side. Never met any of my father's relatives, and so it was wonderful to hear the stories of you know, his childhood and growing up. So that was really interesting. And then my father, I'm sorry, I hope you don't mind.
No,
I'm going to keep going.
Not.
Okay. So my father really loved music. I grew up listening to classical music. He loved music. And so he would listen to the Inc Brothers. He would listen to classical music. He would listen to jazz. I mean, sometimes some very complex music. And it was interesting because, you know, you don't, you know, I'm sure there are a lot of other families that do. Maybe it just seemed interesting to me. But, and so I always wondered where his love of music came from. And my dad, at one time when he lived in Mexico, was burned badly in a fire. And so his back was scarred from the fire. And so when we met these uncles of mine, and we were all sitting around talking, they asked him, "Do you still play the violin?" Now, the interesting, the irony in this is that when I was in grade school, I wanted to learn to play the violin simply because I learned to love the music that he played, and I wanted to learn to play the violin. My dad was horribly against it. He did not want me to play the violin, did not want me to get the instrument. And I never could understand why, because he loved the music. And so then they asked him, "Do you still play the violin?" My ears perked up, and I was like, "What? You know, he played the violin? You never said anything about this to me or any of us." And so then he goes, no, I never played again. And like, I'm looking at my dad like, I never knew you played the violin. And so it was just like all of these emotions are running through me. And I'm just like, oh, my gosh. So the story was that when my father was in this fire where he almost died and was badly burned, the skin on his arm had, you know, adhered. You know, it had burned and closed the arm, so he couldn't extend it. It was in this. It was like this, you know, where all the skin had connected, and then he couldn't move it anymore. So it was just like this. And so my grandfather didn't know what to do with this child and thought, he's going to be a pauper, he's going to be living in the streets, he'll never have a way to earn a living. So he thought, well, I'll teach him how to play the violin. We'll make sure he knows how to play an instrument, because his hand is already like this, it's shaped for the violin. That makes perfect sense. So they, you know, got my father a violin and made him learn how to play the violin. I never knew that. I never absolutely did not know that. Eventually, a doctor came to the town and, you know, I disconnected the skin. So my dad's arm was free now and he could use it. So the violin went away and he never played it. But it was a story that I never knew. And it solved a puzzle, you know, for me, because I never understood. It was a mystery. I never understood why he loved the music so much but didn't want me to play the violin. So... Can you hold? Because I think it's Alice.
Okay.
Okay.
Back.
Okay.
So, did your father, after his arm was fixed, he didn't want to play the violin anymore? He didn't have a...
I don't think he had. I think it was a bad memory for him or a bad experience for him. It wasn't something he was passionate about. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, at least in the conversation that he was having with his brother, that's the impression that I got. So.
Did you talk to other Bassetto families? And if you did, what did you talk about?
Other Bassetto families. I think all of us that grew up in Oxnard or in Colonia, but not necessarily in Colonia, but in Oxnard, talked about being a Bracero or growing up with families that were from, you know, that were Bracero, so that migrated here to work. I think sometimes the differences in cultures, and there was, you know, that going on. I think also there was class divisions or racial divisions in the town. I don't think that we were as diverse as we are now. I think that's happened over years. I don't think that ever happens automatically. So I think the fact that, well, I remember that the Oxnard Theater. And I don't know if you remember this.
The Central Boulevard or the Oxford Theater on East
Street? There was an
Oxford. Because we had our own theater.
There was the theater that only Mexicanos went to. And then there was the Oxnard Theater on A Street. But then it was sectioned off.
And then there was the Vogue.
But then the Mexican Theater, I remember there was a section that Latinos would sit in. You know.
Did you tell him about when you said your dad would bring a lot of the braceros over to eat?
Well, we touched on it a little bit, you know, but yeah, he would do that. So, yes, there was that, and I think, you know, the fact that, you know, there was the discussion of our culture. I remember, you know, early on that they didn't want you to marry outside of your race or outside of, you know, they wanted you to stay within your own culture. So, you know, I'm trying to think of what some of the memories were.
Did the men talk to you about how lonely they were?
They would talk about how they missed their families, you know, and how lonely they were. But, you know, when you bring that up and it's, you know, it triggers things. But I remember I have a friend whose father was here, and I can't remember exactly what kind of work he was doing, or whether they were braceros or not. But I remember that they also used to migrate to go back and forth from Mexico to here. They'd go back and forth. But the dad had a pickup truck, and what he did was on the bottom of the pickup truck were all the supplies because they were going to travel all the way to Mexico City. So all the supplies, and then the diapers were cloth diapers, and so the mom would cut, during the year she would be cutting diapers out of the scraps of fabric or cloth or t-shirts or whatever, and then continue to stack them all up because of the road trip, you know, that they would have to go on. And then the plank that the father built, and then there was beds for the kids, you know, for them to sleep on because it was a pickup truck. So the back part, they would be sleeping back there, and then underneath would have all the provisions, but on the top would be the beds. And they would travel back and forth to Mexico to visit their families. Mm. Yeah.
And you said when you were 3, your dad had to return to Mexico. Was that when the Bracero project was ending?
For him, his contract had ended. Yeah. And so what happened at that time, I'm not sure if at that time he was already working for Coastal Growers or if it was... if it was Seaboard or Coastal Growers that he was working for, but it was one of his employers that sponsored him and enabled him to come back to the United States to live as a resident. Mm. So that's what happened. That's not me.
Sorry, it was my story.
So when somebody tunes in at the Smithsonian,
they're going to hear the stomach growl. All right. And how long was your father back in Mexico for, trying to get residency in the United States?
I think he was there maybe a year and a half, maybe 2 years.
And Did you write letters back and forth, or?
Mm-hmm. He wrote letters. I have a lot of letters that he and my mom would write back and forth. Some of them are really personal because I didn't know we had them. I found them just maybe 2 years ago. And I gave them to one of my sisters. I wrapped them up and I gave them to her because she really wanted a memory of our parents, and so I gave them to her. So I think, Alice, you read some of them, huh? And so it was really interesting to see, you know, so to read some of the letters and to know, you know, there was still a doubt in my mom's mind about whether he was going to return or not. And here she was with all of these children because she had all these children, and then she had me and my younger sister. She hadn't had the youngest yet. Obviously, my dad returned because we have a third one. But yeah, you can tell in the letters that there was this, yes, I'm going to return, don't worry, I'm going to come home. And because he was saying this home, you know, so obviously there was an attachment here. But she was really concerned that, you know, that he wasn't. And so, you know, the letters are, you know, the birth of my sister, and, you know, because she was pregnant when he left. And mm-hmm. So she was born, he wasn't here. And, you know, the letter going back saying you have another daughter and, you know, all of these things. So
one of the letters that she shared said that Elenita, which is little Helen, because she was named after her mom, Maria Elena, that she asked about her dad. Remember you told me that one letter?
I was asking for him.
When you were little?
That the letter her mom wrote to him was saying, she's asking for you. She was asking about her dad.
Yeah. Which I had a really close, I was very close to my dad. So.
And do you remember, would your mom tell you that your dad was writing you letters?
No. She would, whenever we got a letter, I mean, I think this is why I remember this part of my life so much, is that, you know, that I was missing him, but also that my mother let me know that, yeah, he's still in touch, he's writing, and he sent you this, or he sent you this, and... You know, so there was that attachment still.
And when your father was gone, did he send money for you to live, or how did you manage?
You know, I don't know if he did or not. I really don't know. I'm trying to think. I can't even imagine whether he'd have the money to send, because if he were making any money in Mexico, it wasn't going to be a whole lot to send us. My mom was always working. And so I know that my mom was working. I remember going to sitters' houses, you know, or aunts or somebody to be taken care of. So I don't remember that any money was sent back. You know, he may have left her someone he loved, but...
Right. Yeah. And do you remember the day when your father returned?
You know, I don't. I don't remember. I remember... being really close to him when he was here. When he was here, I remember growing up and being very close to my dad. I remember that he would come home and there I was. I would not leave his side. So I do remember that. I remember growing up and seeing he was really an avid news person. You know, he really liked politics and listening to the news and being really educated on what was happening, not only here but throughout the world. He loved history. He was a history buff. I mean, he really enjoyed that. Reading, he was always reading, which all of those things were really great for us, for me, for my sisters, because I'm an avid reader. I love the news. I stay up to date with everything that's going on. Right. I mean, so all of this has rubbed off, you know. I mean, and I can remember seeing some news events, and I remember it brings you back when I see old news reels. Mm-hmm. I can remember seeing them on a little TV screen, you know. So
it's the black and white.
Yeah. Yeah, so it was, you know, just seeing that.
And about how long was your father at Braceto for?
Well, I think his contract was 3 years, but I think at some point it must have been renewed because he was here for a much longer time. So I don't know at when it
Didn't you
was
have
renewed.
Something?
I had a contract.
You should.
Yeah, they you have one in your archives or whatever, but there was a contract there. But I think it was, if I remember correctly, I'd have to look at it, but I remember, I think it was for a 3-year span, and then they would renew it, and then it would be renewed. So I'm not sure.
So when he returned to Mexico, that was because the contract had ended.
And the program had ended.
No, the program in general had ended.
Mm-hmm.
So then he had to apply
mm-hmm.
for residency
mm-hmm.
here in the United States
mm-hmm.
after that.
Mm-hmm.
So after he returned, that you said he like helped other people to learn how to read and that kind of stuff. He didn't live at the Braceto
mm-mm.
camps anymore.
He lived at home with my mom and us, yeah.
And how would you say that the Braceto program affected your life?
I used to go to the labor camps when they'd have, at Christmas time, the owners or the growers would have a huge Christmas party at the camp. And I remember going to those and seeing all these men, you know, at least have a celebration, a really nice dinner, you know, speeches and awards would be given out. I think I learned to appreciate, you know, what I had, even though it wasn't a whole lot. You know, I think even at that time I felt like we had a lot more than other people. So there's always been that kind of thought instilled in us, that there were people less, you know, that had much less than you did. That people come here to this country to learn, to work, to prosper. That what they're leaving behind isn't necessarily what they want to leave behind. It's there's a reason why they're doing that. So that was just a part of you. That I think if you talk to anybody that was involved with anyone that came here to work, that is just a part of you because you know what they've left behind. You know the sacrifices that people have made so that you can have a better life. And my dad came here to not only help his family, but to really make something, to have a better life. He knew that he could do something better here than he could in his own country even then. So it was, you know, coming here with the idea that he was going home, a lot of people thought, well, I'm just coming here to work and then I'm going home. But after they're here, a lot of times some of them decided to either file for residency and stayed here, or citizenship and stayed here, because they knew that they could do better here in the United States than they could in their own country.
And did your dad ever tell you of how he heard about the Braceto program, like how he decided to enroll in it?
Yeah, he wrote. He actually wrote a story that he was writing before he passed away. There was a story that he was writing, and I don't know if you got copies of some of it. It may have been in some of the papers that I gave you. But when he came here to the United States, there was a war. There was a shortage of workers, and so they had gone, you know, there were growers that went to Mexico to recruit men to come here to work in the fields. And so there was a lot of discussion that he had with his mom. I mean, I remember him telling me that they didn't want him to come because they were afraid he would be drafted mm-hmm. and taken into and then be sent to war. And they didn't want him to do that. And they were really afraid of him coming here. And part of the story talks about how his mother went with him to the train station before he loaded got on the train and to come here to the United States, and she was really, just really fearful that she would never see her son again. Unfortunately, she didn't see him maybe 2 times since he came to the United States, so that was really a shame. And then she passed away before my dad could get there, so that was always a real a regret on his part. You know, it was something that he had to live with. And I remember when she died, I was about 13 years old, and I remember talking to him and his sorrow because he was unable to to go to the to Mexico to be with her when she was ill and dying.
And do you have any final memories or stories that you'd like to share with us before we end the interview?
Oh, my gosh.
If so, you can go for it.
I have so many. I don't know. I don't even know where to begin. I mean, my father was a wonderful man, and he touched a lot of lives here.
He's very intelligent, very smart.
I hope that when I pass, that my children love and respect me the way that I did him. I didn't expect to get all teary.
Okay.
There's a lot of fun memories, a lot of sad memories, a lot of wonderful experiences, lessons that he taught us, because he wanted us, both my parents, they wanted us to be good people, good caring people, and to be giving, to give back. And I think a lot of us grew up that way. My brothers and sisters are very share. They share. They're not afraid to share with strangers or other people. Some of the work I do has always been in giving back, and I think I got that from both of my parents. But my dad, I think, set a wonderful example for us and a wonderful way to live our lives by. But as a child, some of the memories, my dad was alive to play jokes on us, so he used to. He had a metal lunchbox that my mom would pack his lunch in and take it to him. He'd pack it and go off to work early in the morning because, their work was early mornings, late nights, and so he would go off to work. But when we'd all be waiting for him to come home because he had the treats, my mom would pack him special lunches, and so he had treats. So when he got home, we were hoping he'd leave a little bit for us because with so many kids, you don't get a lot of treats. So we would always be fighting over who got the lunchbox when he came walking through the door. And sometimes my dad, being, the prankster that he was, he would catch rabbits or lizards or sparrows. And so we never knew what was going to come out of that lunchbox. Sometimes it was, a bird, but the rabbits are the ones that we really loved because they would just hop out at us, and we'd keep them. We'd try to raise them. Eventually, he'd have to put them back, and my mom would, okay, you got to take it back to the fields now. So, it would go away. But yeah, some of those are fun memories. But I have so many. I don't know which one would be better than others. And he was a wonderful man. He was a good hard worker, and he was very well respected in the community. He was liked by a lot of people. And, what can you say? If that's what you leave behind as a legacy, I think you've done a really good job and you've lived your life well. So.
Well, thank you for sharing your memories and times with us. We really
appreciate it. Thanks.
And we learned a lot. And
thanks.
Just really thank you for taking part in this.
I really love it. I'm so thrilled that all of you are doing this because it's a part of our history. Mm-hmm. It really is a part of our history that a lot of people don't have and they don't understand. And it really it talks about, we miss a lot of this stuff about, a lot of our children don't understand why some people speak fluent Spanish and others don't. And the fact that, one of the things I didn't talk about was the fact that my mom, when she worked in the packing house or worked in agriculture, ag workers were never eligible for unemployment because it wasn't considered real work. And so a lot of these people that worked seasonal work weren't eligible for unemployment, and it didn't happen until the 50s or 60s,
In the 60s,
before they started earning unemployment. And it's really important for all these young adults and people that are working in the United States to know the history of labor. It's something that a lot of people don't know, and why unions have evolved and not now, and why soon, hopefully, there'll be a revolution. Why hopefully the unions will reemerge, because so many of our laws and so many of our rights are going away, And people don't realize how important all of these things were and what happened to have them put in place. So that's my soapbox. I don't get on that. It's a whole other story.
Thank you again.
Okay.